You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
There's been a 13% rise in homelessness since Mayor de Blasio took office. 57,390 people live in the city's homeless shelters, and nearly half of them are children. That comes as no surprise to the Women's Center for Education and Career Advancement, which for the past 14 years has arranged for updates of the self-sufficiency standard for New York City. Here to discuss the findings and policy recommendations in the latest self-sufficiency report called Overlooked and Undercounted, The Struggle to Make Ends Meet in New York City, are Merble Reagan, Executive Director of the Women's Center for Education and Career Advancement, Nicole Gallant, Senior Vice President for Community Impact, the United Way of New York City, and Jennifer McLean, Vice President, Community Impact, City Harvest. Welcome to our show.
Thank you.
Merble, this is the fourth edition of the report, and it actually combines two series. What are they?
Yes, they are. It combines the self-sufficiency standard for the city of New York, which measures what it costs to live and work in New York City based on the borough in which a family lives and the number of children as well as their ages. Mm-hmm. So that is the report that this is actually the fourth edition. What we've added this time, which is really important, is a demographic study that looks at how many working New Yorkers are above or below the self-sufficiency standard and who they are.
Is that important to know as a result of the Great Recession?
We think so, because the people that we're talking about are our neighbors, our relatives, our friends. What we find very often is that people say, you know, I had no idea that this was the extent of income insecurity in New York City on the parts of people who work every day.
When we say that it measures how much income a family of a certain composition in a given place must earn to meet their basic needs, what are the basic needs?
The basic needs are shelter, food, child care, medical care, and then a range of miscellaneous expenses, as well as payroll taxes.
Now, we're talking about New York City. If you use the federal poverty level as the guide for New York City, how does that change the number of people that you designate as actually being poor?
Well, part of our goal with these reports, and especially with the 2014 report, is to shift the discussion away from who's poor to what do people need and how do we as a city help them move in the direction of income security as opposed to income inadequacy. And so we don't really compare, because the point of the self-sufficiency work is that we want to know how to help people move not just from poverty but closer to the kind of income and supports they actually need to take care of their families.
Nicole, the findings for 2014 are daunting. 42% of people are living below the self-sufficiency standard. Mm-hmm. 42%. The federal poverty threshold for a two-person family was $15,730. But this report finds that in the least expensive area to live in New York City, the same family would require an income of $52,776. And that's just living a bare-bones, mm-hmm. self-sufficient existence.
Mm-hmm. And what's even more shocking, I think, is realizing that the large majority of people who are living below the standard are working. Four-fifths of everyone who actually is living below the self-sufficiency standard have at least one working adult in the home.
How will the United Way use this information in its work?
We use it in a few different ways. This is one of the sort of baseline principles for us and the way that we organize everything we do. We actually believe that it's critical for us to really play a driving role working with several partners like City Harvest, like the Women's Center, like the New York Community Trust Foundation's businesses to actually organize folks in a sense of really with the purpose of making sure more New Yorkers are on the path to self-sufficiency. So we're looking at the key data, looking at the places where people are poorest, looking at the places where folks can access, you know, key education supports and pathways to advancement, actually, in their careers through education, and key employment supports, of course.
Jennifer, City Harvest just completed its marathon repackaging of bulk food donations for families at Thanksgiving. How many families did you help feed last week?
With that amount, we packed 230,000 pounds of Thanksgiving meals, and that feeds, if you figure about a little over a pound a person for a meal, you feed, you know, hundreds of thousands of people with that food, and we had so many people that wanted to get involved and help with that. And for us, when we look at the study, we think about the food budget is the one place that you're going to compensate. You can't compensate with rent. You can't compensate with childcare. But food, it's elastic. So if you need to scale back, that happens. And so a parent might scale back so they make sure they have enough food for their family and skipping meals. So that's where City Harvest uses this report.
Has there been a rise in giving? Yesterday was Giving Tuesday. Are the 1% giving more to help those in need?
You know, City Harvest is New York City's biggest private response to hunger, and we rely solely on, almost solely on donations from not only the 1%, but our direct mail campaigns and really the City of New York.
And restaurants are also very, very generous.
Financial donors from the City of New York and restaurants donating not only their time, but the food that they donate. So I would say giving is definitely up. People, New York is very generous. Restaurants want to feed their neighbors. The community wants to, you know, send a $50 check into City Harvest so they see our trucks on the road picking up and dropping off food.
Marvel, how many men, women, and children are added to poverty status by accounting for how much more it costs to live in New York City?
We think the number is considerable. And we believe that this report is an opportunity for many sectors in New York City to come together. Government, business, small, medium, and large-sized employers, to have a conversation. We think that the numbers speak for themselves. So given these numbers, once they are all accepted, what do we do as a community in a more collaborative way to take a look at the proposed recommendations and make a decision about what we might accomplish, especially in an environment where the current administration is very amenable to listening to this information and working together with all of us to do something for the families.
It's very difficult to gather census data.
Yes.
How did you gather this information?
I did not personally gather it.
Well, I mean your organization and the people you relied on.
And the people that we relied on used the American Community Survey primarily to update this information.
My guests are Merbel Reagan, Executive Director of the Women's Center for Education and Career Advancement, Nicole Gallant, Senior Vice President for Community Impact at the United Way of New York City, and Jennifer McLean, Vice President of Community Impact at City Harvest. And we are talking about the basic amount of money you need, income you need to live in New York City. We're not talking comfortably. We're just talking about subsistence?
That's right.
Yeah.
The Nicole, the Self-Sufficiency Standard for New York report in 2010 suggested that the cost of living has far outpaced wages. And this one, the one for 2014, revealed an even larger gap.
Mm-hmm.
How much of an increase have we seen between the two reports?
We actually looked at the baseline of 2000 to track the increase, and we saw approximately a 59% increase in the cost of food, a roughly 59% increase in the cost of housing.
Despite the fact that inflation levels are supposed to be pretty flat?
Right. And if you actually take a look at the data points looking at wages and costs of living according to the 2010 data, we see still wages rising by about 17%, but really a 45% rise in the cost of living. So it's this sort of what we call, or what we heard referred to yesterday by one of our wonderful panelists as the alligator jaws, sort of this, you know, gap, this chasm that's growing and growing, and that, you know, will not allow even folks who are earning what they need to earn to be self-sufficient to catch up with the cost of living because those costs are rising so astronomically.
The report, Marble, concluded that to be self-sufficient in New York City, the median earnings for two adults, one preschool, and one school-aged child living in the Bronx went from $48,077 in 2000 to $70,319 in 2014. $70,000.
It does seem remarkable.
And wages have been flat for most workers during the same period.
Mm-hmm.
That is absolutely right. So the increase over that period of time is actually 46%, which is quite considerable. Mm-hmm. I mean, one of the recommendations that we would like to sort of stimulate a discussion about is the possibility of indexing increases in the minimum wage, or what some people refer to as a living wage.
Well, do any of you see that as possible in the current political climate?
I think for us, we see that at least the discussion is possible. We have an administration that seems to be amenable to listening to the information.
You're talking about de Blasio or Obama?
I am. Well, we don't have much control over the federal
legislation. Well, the federal government, for example, Jennifer, the federal government is now cutting back on food stamps.
I know, and if you think about the food stamp level, so if you're making $23,500 for a family of four, you qualify for food stamps. And if you anything above that, you don't qualify. The federal poverty number is national, so whether you're in New York City or in Colorado or Utah, it's the same number. So we know that even if you're at that federal poverty level and you're getting help with food stamps, you still are going to need help. Well, obviously, we see that with the self-sufficiency study. You need to be making upwards of $59,000, $60,000 in some places in New York City, right, to be able to afford it. So even if you're getting government benefits, you still need help. So the food stamps are just a start to help people, and they are cutting them, which is the wrong thing, because you actually stimulate the economy when you use food stamps. Little grocers make more money. The economy goes round.
Do food costs vary according to neighborhood the way rent and other costs do?
Definitely. We see food costs are definitely lower in the outer boroughs of New York City. But the study is showing us that a 59% increase overall when looking at New York City food costs. And, you know, food costs, even for healthy and nutritious food, is actually the most difficult thing for people. If you think about these folks trying to survive in their community, they're dealing with so many things, medical expenses, rent. The last thing on their mind is how I'm going to feed my family as nutritiously as possible. They would like to, but it's very challenging.
And rents have gone up?
Mm-hmm. We've seen rents rise dramatically. But one of the reasons actually that Merble brought up this opportunity to work with this administration is that we're really excited by some of the developments that the administration is making in terms of key policies like housing. It's an affordable housing plan, which we believe, you know, as a baseline and with the potential to expand, really could be one of those really critical controls. But we outlined several other policy recommendations in the paper.
Well, why do you think we've seen this 13% rise in homelessness since Mayor de Blasio took office? I mean, since the city's policies have been, as you say, amenable to correcting these problems?
It's not clear to me that it has actually risen under this administration, but the way that the numbers have been calculated has changed.
Mm-hmm. So it's simply a matter of how we're counting who's homeless and who isn't?
I think that's a distinct possibility.
And I believe this administration is pretty clear about getting much more, accurate numbers and data to understand and pinpoint where the problems are and how we direct the solutions.
Well, how we even deal with the homeless is an issue. In my neighborhood, there are a number of homeless people who have been living in the park. They've been thrown out of their homes by their families because they are alcoholics, and the city was not going to do anything. Actually, the local church is going to have to take them in, and the neighborhood is going to have to come up with ways of resolving this problem.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. I mean, it's hard to prioritize who among the homeless should have priority in terms of our attention, but I would hope that that number would include people who are working full-time and doing the right thing, trying to take care of their families, and yet do not earn enough money to pay for permanent housing. Mm-hmm. I mean, these are people who are living by the rules, and yet they don't earn enough to be able to move outside of shelter.
Isn't part of the problem the defining affordable housing? When Mayor Bloomberg talked about it, people said, well, your idea of affordable housing isn't necessarily somebody else's idea of affordable housing.
I think that's true, but I want to add in that, you know, one of the challenges that a lot of people face is not necessarily whether they can access affordable housing, it is a major problem for most. There's nowhere near enough affordable housing in the city. But another major issue that has been brought to light, and that is, you know, one of the strategies we actually try to, account for in this report, is the fact that a lot of folks are living so close to the line. They're so vulnerable that with 1 or 2 months of variability in their income, they don't have enough elasticity to actually, you know, keep up with rent payments or mortgage payments. And so then they are the ones who are put into temporary, you know, housing and into that system. So I think there's, you know, definitely a case to be made around, you know, looking at affordable housing. But the real benefit of this update of the self-sufficiency calculator is that it takes into account the need, the dire need for emergency savings to be able to weather these kinds of fluctuations in income and changes in, you know, other costs and expenses.
We are discussing a new report on self-sufficiency called Overlooked and Undercounted, The Struggle to Make Ends Meet in New York City. My guests are Nicole Gallant of the United Way of New York, Jennifer McLean of City Harvest, and Myrbal Reagan of the Women's Center for Education and Career Advancement. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We are back with Myrbal Reagan, Executive Director of the Women's Center for Education and Career Advancement, Nicole Gallant, Senior Vice President for Community Impact at the United Way of New York City, and Jennifer McLean, Vice President and Community Impact at City Harvest. And we are talking about what we have learned from the latest self-sufficiency standard of New York City report, this one called Overlooked and Undercounted, The Struggle to Make Ends Meet in New York City. And Nicole, do we know from this report some of the characteristics of the families who live in poverty, their education, the number of children, their occupations, their employment patterns?
We do. And we know a lot more about what I describe as the face of poverty in New York City, and it's a very common face. It's a face you see at the cashier who, you know, checks you out at the Macy's counter, that works in Starbucks, that works in, you know, it works for the subway.
On Walmart here.
We're not picking on anybody. The point is, I think, it's most of us.
Because New York hasn't let Walmart in.
but it's most of us. And it's, you know, it is not a face that is, you know, a particular color or a particular gender or a particular age. This is an issue that permeates all of New York City, every single corner of the city.
Now, Mayor Bloomberg's administration developed a yardstick for poverty in New York City. Were his conclusions different from the conclusions we have here?
Well, I think under the Bloomberg administration, the CEO measure is definitely an improvement over the federal poverty level. But that measure is measuring poverty, and we're measuring income adequacy, which is a little different. It's in a different place along the spectrum.
Because these people can get along, but they get along sometimes in a way that we would prefer not to see people get along.
They're not actually getting along. The measure says these are people who are not poor. It doesn't mean they have enough to take care of their families. And we would like to shift that discussion from who's poor to what do families actually need and how can we help them get to that place.
And in this report, you accounted for 152 different variations,
yes,
like one adult plus one preschooler, two adults plus an infant, two adults plus one teenager. And then you looked at how much it costs each of those families to live in different parts of the city.
Mm-hmm. That's absolutely true. We think that it's very important to look at the specificity to the extent possible of what families' actual expenses are. So families with very young children have child care as a major expense. Families with school-age children have a different configuration of expenses. And we go all the way through at the end to, I believe it is four. And also what we're seeing in New York City, because families cannot afford housing to the extent that they could, is that many families are now blended, maybe putting together more than one traditional family so that they can afford housing.
Also, the example often used of a single mother, you're suggesting it no longer applies, because we're also talking about the ideal nuclear family that's so often cited.
Well, we wanted to take into consideration in this current report a wider variety of family types, because that reflects the reality for many New York City families.
Yeah, I think it's important to note that, you know, we're seeing a much heavier, you know, much more significant challenge in terms of income adequacy for people with children. But it is not necessarily, you know, only single mothers. We see, you know, following pretty quickly behind. It's just an adult with a child.
Will Mayor de Blasio's universal pre-K have an impact on child care for some of the poorest?
Gonna go for it?
I think it will indeed. We are also interested in, you know, cradle to K, child care for families, because we think that universal pre-K is an incredibly important step forward, but we have to look at the issue of child care for all children for those families that have working adults. We'd also like to talk a little bit about what we are recommending as policy changes that might be part of a larger discussion about how we address the needs of working families.
Have other cities – well, you wanted to add something, Jennifer.
It's just interesting. People are always surprised at the people that go to soup kitchens and food pantries. They think it's a homeless population in New York City. And we know, that 1.4 million people are food insecure in New York City. So what started as an emergency need back in – when we started in the early 80s really was an emergency. I need food today. But usually people weren't relying on soup kitchens and food pantries for a normal way of life. And I sit and read this report and I listen to this discussion and think about the families that are now having to attend a pantry to get groceries once a week or a soup kitchen to have a hot meal. It's now a regular part of their existence. It's every week, it's regular, and it's not an emergency anymore. It's a standard way of living.
So self-sufficiency implies no assistance, but these families actually need some help at some point.
And a great way to get that is through a soup kitchen or a food pantry.
Mm-hmm. So are you seeing a lot of children coming in these days?
Oh, absolutely. The high chairs now that are stacked up in most soup kitchens that you go to are quite astounding. And the other thing is that not only soup kitchens but food pantries, there's a lot more food pantries in the city than soup kitchens. And that's really where you have a home or you have somewhere to cook this food. You just need to go pick up free groceries and bring it home.
How many food pantries and soup kitchens do you supply?
We work with a little over 400 soup kitchens and food pantries, but there's about over 850 in the city. Mm-hmm. So they are dotted all around. Sometimes you don't know they're there. They're in the basement of a church or, you know, in a community center, and they're there every day. They are on the front lines. We bring food to them, and then they repurpose it for either a hot meal or a pantry bag for their waiting line.
My guests are Jennifer McLean of City Harvest, Nicole Gallant of the United Way of New York City, and Merble Reagan of the Women's Center for Education and Career Advancement. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. New York is often called the most expensive city in the country, is it? How does it compare to San Francisco or Chicago?
I don't have those numbers handy, but from our perspective, it is.
And it's the city with the highest level of income inadequacy, right? So, I mean, dramatically higher than most other cities and many other states, including Mississippi.
Despite the fact that we have an awful lot of people with a lot of money. We're not the poorest city in the country, just the most income inadequacy.
Mm-hmm. But that's one of the reasons why we think this is really a city of possibility, is that we have the resources, just, you know, with genius, you know, strategies like City Harvest's, you know, food rescue. We have fantastic, I think, partners in like the Women's Center and others who care deeply about figuring out what those solutions are to actually change that reality.
Jennifer, it doesn't seem like the federal assistance programs can meet the needs of New Yorkers. So has the new health care program had any impact on people struggling to make ends meet?
You know, I can't speak to that very much. What I do know is that they are talking about that New York State had one of the best enrollments of that. I think it was in the news today that, that New York State had over 1 million people sign up and that it's been hugely successful. So that showed there was a need for it to have coverage.
I guess this is the time when we come to suggestions for how the situation can be improved. Now, how realistic can we be, considering the current situation in Washington?
We think this is an opportune time to discuss what might be possible. And we make recommendations over three broad areas. We think that wages should be increased to align and keep pace with the cost of living.
So this is something that can be done on the city level, as we've seen in Seattle and some other places.
And San Francisco. Yeah. Mm-hmm. We think, secondly, that employment, and we should take a look at employment in New York City to the extent that that's possible, engaging, of course, business and employers of all sizes, to take a look at how we can better structure employment as a pathway to self-sufficiency and economic security.
And I just want to add in that we've had a really wonderful set of partners step up as in response to the report, who are very interested in figuring out how to be those kinds of supports for their workers, for their frontline workers, for the child care workers, for the cashiers, for the various folks who, you know, are living on the verge or under the level of self-sufficiency, and who are structuring really smart programs and strategies to move folks up the career pathway.
Employment is linked to education. What does the United Way want to see done with respect to education of the poorest?
We have a whole body of work around education and are thinking very carefully about what the interconnection and interdependences between education as really the fundamental strategy for, and really the lead, the driver for self-sufficiency, and that's what the data shows us. But then the interdependence with employment and, you know, self-sufficient wages as the complement. So we are actually looking to ensure that more kids are not only getting through school, progressing through school and getting the kind of education they need, but they're graduating college and career ready. So they actually have some of those building blocks in place to be able to be living wage earners.
Now, if someone doesn't have a lot of money and needs to find housing, there are certain areas that are less expensive than others. Does it usually mean living pretty far away from the center of Manhattan, from where the jobs are?
It depends on your family
composition.
I think
New Yorkers expect to commute, so to speak. Yeah.
But I know in Brooklyn, for example, South Brooklyn obviously is more expensive than North Brooklyn. There are parts of the Bronx that are very expensive and parts that are relatively inexpensive.
I think what we find is that working families are willing to commute to get the best opportunity for work and income. But I think you make a good point, and it leads me to our third area of recommendations, which is recognizing that for many of these families, the journey to economic self-sufficiency is just that, and that there are points along the way, and there are times when better access to quality, affordable housing, food, and child care is going to make it possible for them to move closer to economic self-sufficiency.
Of course, commuting is expensive as well in New York, and the price of the subway fare is about to go up again. Jennifer, a lot of poor people rely on fast food to get by. Do you offer an alternative, or do we just have to accept the fact that the least expensive meals are the ones that most people are going to have to go to?
You know, I have an ad posted in my office as a reminder from a fast food chain that says, here's our dollar menu. Now you can afford to pay your rent. And that really,
that's painful.
It's painful. Mm-hmm. And I remind myself every day, because the communities that we work in, it's not hunger the way I grew up understanding hunger. And it's more about low income, trying to make it work. It's the self-sufficiency information we're learning here. So fast food is easy, it's quick, it's incredibly affordable. It's hard to ask people to make a different choice when they have balancing so many things. So what we're trying to do is go in those communities and talk to people about, you can make a different choice. It's not as hard as you might think. Let's work together. Let us show you what we've learned and what we know and how you can go to the supermarket, buy healthy stuff with your benefits, and stretch it and make it work quickly. And it all has to be quick, really quick for people. They're really busy.
I thank you all so much for being on our show. Jennifer McLean is Vice President of Community Impact at City Harvest. Nicole Gallant, I'm sorry, why am I stumbling on your name, Nicole? It's a really hard name to pronounce. Senior Vice President for Community Impact, United Way of New York City. And Merble Reagan is Executive Director of the Women's Center for Education and Career Advancement. It's been a pleasure having you on our show, even if the story you're telling us is a little scary.
But it's hopeful.